Hello everyone, and welcome to CRAMSurg, clinical research appraisal and methodology for surgical trainees, where we pick a paper fresh from the press on a hot general surgical topic. We review it for you, we present it for you, we critique its methodology for you, and provide top-of-the-field expert opinion and teaching on research appraisal and methodology. My name is Gio Perrin, and together with Professor Sababala Subramanian and Maria Digby, we bring you CRAMSurg, from the wonderful region of the Yorkshire and the Humber. Welcome back, everyone. Today we are going to have a look at a paper attempting to design a prediction tool for perforated appendicitis. This will be followed by a teaching session on Spearman's correlation and how to run it on Jamovi. I'll leave you to it.
Hello, guys. My name is Pratik. I'm one of the surgical registrars working in Rotherham General Hospital. I'm joined by Shadman, one of our SHOs, and together we are going to present this paper titled 48-hour symptom threshold predicts perforated appendicitis, development of a clinical risk model. This paper was published just last month in the World Journal of Surgery and comes out of Japan. So I'll hand over to Shadman for the next bit to discuss methodology, and over to you, Shadman. Just gonna try and change the slides. Having some trouble. Oh, there it is.
Yeah. So, hi everyone. This is Shadman. So, let's have a little run through the background. So, the background of this is basically based on appendicitis and how to detect the perforated and normal appendicitis. As we all know, appendicectomies are one of the most common emergency procedures that is performed everywhere. And one of the most difficult is the perforated appendicitis, which is usually associated with significantly increased postoperative morbidity. It is crucial to diagnose these types of patient with perforation early and accurately so that we can prioritize their surgical management. That was what the authors here were interested to in quantifying the relationship between the symptoms duration related to the perforated appendicitis, and tried to make a predictive model with some other variables there. The aim of this study was to investigate the impact of time from the symptom onset to hospital presentation, and based it on the risk of perforation and incorporate these findings into a predictive model, as we said. This is an observational research study, a retrospective cohort study, but we did not find any groups of cohort here, so we'll say retrospective observational study. It was undertaken in two urban secondary care hospitals in Tokyo, Japan. Electronic health records were from the April 2019 to October 2023 were reviewed for all patients of any age who were having surgery for acute appendicitis. Total study was 548 patients, from which the final cohort included 414 patients, and they categorized the interval of symptoms ranging from less than 12 hours to 96 hours. Some other variables were also introduced, like fever, presence of fecal-lithon imaging, CRP, and the primary outcome was to detect the perforated appendicitis, which was defined intraoperatively by a visible defect in the appendiceal wall or gross intraperitoneal contamination, which was later confirmed by histopathology. Here we can see the exclusion criteria, where there is missing data for around 100 patient diagnosis of non-appendicitis in about 18 and cognitive impairment of 1, which make the final cohorts analyze as 414. Here we can see a lot of high statistical categories that they used to design the study. There were categorical variables were presented as counts and percentages, and continuous variables were tested for normality with the Shapiro-Wilk test. Variables that satisfied the normality assumptions are reported as mean or median IQR compared by t-test or Mann-Whitney test. Univariate analysis used g-square or Fisher's exact tests. Receiver operating characteristics, that is ROC curves, determine the cutoffs via the Yodan index variable with P less than 0.05 or clinical relevance, entered a multivariable logistics regression. to estimate the beta coefficients, then the odd ratios, and the confidence interval was 95%. Model discrimination and calibration were assessed by AUC, the area under curve and bootstrap calibration plots, and a Bayesian logistic regression with non-informative priors provided the posterior estimates with 95% credible intervals via the MCMC sampling. Convergence was verified by some trace plots, and all the statistics analyses were performed using the R version 4.3.2. This is all the things about the study design. Now the results will be discussed by my colleague Pratik.
Thank you, Shadman. Sorry. Okay, so talking about the baseline characteristics of the population, the median age was 36 years with a range of 8 to 87 years. 43 patients were in the pediatric age group. 52.7% of the population was male, BMI of 21.8, a median BMI. 24% had a fever on admission. Prior appendicitis was found in 15.2% of patients. 39% had appendicolith. Median white cell count was 13,000. Median CRP was 1.47. CT was performed in 97% of these cases. 80% of the patients presented within 48 hours of symptom onset. The admission to surgery interval was 9 hours and 25 minutes mean. The operative time was a mean of 53.7 minutes. Perforation was found in 18.6% of the patients. Surgical site infection was found in 4.6% of the patients, and post-operative stay was 5.5 days mean. So in this table, they have compared the baseline characteristics between perforated and non-perforated appendicitis. And they found that increased age, appendicolith, and initial CRP, raised initial CRP value were found in statistically significantly higher numbers in patients with perforated appendicitis, as also the prevalence of SSIs and a longer hospital stay in the perforated appendicitis group. They did logistical regression to identify presentation of greater than or equal to 24 hours as an independent risk factor for perforation. Symptom to presentation time yielded an area under the curve of 0.76 with an optimal cutoff at 24 hours. However, later thresholds at 48 hours and 72 hours, although showing reduced overall accuracy, specificity and positive likelihood ratios were increased, and this is why they chose the 48-hour cutoff to dichotomize their population into before and after 48 hours of presentation to look at perforated appendicitis. Looking at the CRP, demonstrated superior discrimination with an area under the curve of 0.84, and they found an optimal cutoff of 5.7 milligrams per DL and a non-linear risk relationship on spline analysis. So in this slide, we can look at the ROC curves for the presentation time and on the left, and the and CRP on the right side. So we can see that greater than or equal to 24 hours on the blue has the best area under the curve. However, the specificity is better with greater than equal to 48 hours with a specificity of 92%, and the authors justified possibly using this cutoff for this reason. On looking at the right side, we can see an optimal value of 5.7 for CRP to detect possibility of a perforated appendicitis. And they have done a multivariable logistic regression analysis and showed that duration of symptoms more than 48 hours, a CRP of 5.57, and presence of appendicolith had a statistically significant correlation with perforated appendicitis. prior appendicitis history conferred a non-significant protective effect. Fever, sex, and age did not show much of an effect. And their final model of prediction of perforated appendicitis achieved excellent discrimination with an area under the curve of 0.90 for the ROC analysis, and demonstrated good calibration. And this we can see in this next slide here of their predictive model with an area under the curve of 0.9. And this predictive model incorporates the symptom duration, CRP level, and presence of appendicolith. Now we'll talk about the limitations of the study. The self-reported limitations include that retrospective nature, single-centered design, the recall bias of patients, the underrepresentation of the pediatric and elderly population in the cohort. They did not look into effects of comorbidities or use of immunosuppressive medications, to list a few things that they mentioned there. And they also mentioned that there is a difficulty in generalizability, especially in setups with not with different diagnostic and logistical capabilities. Now, we thought there were a few other limitations. Firstly, an information bias, which is caused by the exclusion of patients without an accurate chart. So 100 patients out of the initial 550 were excluded because they did not have accurate charts, and that can cause a lot of bias in the results of this study. It is unclear what weightage is given to the three arms of this proposed predictive model, including the symptom duration, the CRP, and the phycolith. Was there a sort of risk calculation? Is it points based? Exactly how they want to use this model, it is unclear. Early presentation of perforated appendicitis might not be prioritized for surgery if presentation time of this greater or lesser than 48 hours alone is considered. So, or if we have only this in our minds, then we might not take a sicker patient earlier to theaters, which is a potential problem. 97% of the patients reported having a CT, but there was no comparison with the symptom duration or the predictive model in diagnosing perforation. So was it better? Was it worse? We don't know from their data set. The presence of appendicolith for their predictive model needs a CT scan. Then why not use the CT to diagnose perforation or prioritize the patients? Perforation diagnosed at operation. However, the symptom duration was calculated at presentation. And what happened in between the presentation and the operation, the time period, did that have any effect on what they found at operation or the outcome of the patient? They don't really talk about that. They have mentioned delays, but they don't talk about what happened with that. Then preoperative diagnosis was not mentioned. So who were thought to have a perforated appendicitis, and then did that correlate with the postoperative diagnosis? And the preoperative diagnosis would influence the time they take to go to theater potentially, and institution of medical management potentially. So that could also influence outcomes, but it wasn't mentioned. So in conclusion, we think that symptom duration can be used as a decision support tool, for example, for registrars going to the morning meeting to say which a patient should go first. However, looking at the good and bad things of the paper, we can say that technically it is a well-written paper. It has got a good statistical methodology. The bad things include recall bias and information bias. And looking at the clinical side of things, it addresses a common problem in surgical prioritization of patients with appendicitis. It could be a useful tool in settings with limited diagnostic tools, like rural settings, remote settings without CT scanners. However, they did not compare with the CT scan, and they did not provide any information on the impact of time to surgery from presenting at hospital to surgery. So that's our presentation. Thank you.
As usual, just a brief summary of the discussion we had after the paper presentation. First and foremost, we started by discussing whether we all believe that every appendicitis, if left for long enough, turns into a perforation. And we have ascertained that there are different opinions, both within our group and also published in the literature. We also asked ourselves about the possibility of a number of patients with perhaps self-resolving appendicitis not being included in this study, opening potentially for a selection bias. The same applies for patients that are treated with antibiotics when the diagnosis is perhaps not clear. We also discussed the relevance of the timing between onset of symptoms, attendance, and time to theatres. The latter doesn't seem to have been accounted for by the authors. We will write to the authors and we'll let you know the outcome. I'll leave you to the teaching session.
Talk about statistical tests again, and we're going to talk about Spearman correlation. We're going to go very easy given the time of the day. Not going to talk about anything particularly crazy. And we are going to go through a little bit of gossip about Spearman, the guy we're going to talk about today, and Carl Pearson, the guy we talked about on our last teaching session. So usual disclaimers, I'm not a statistician or an expert in statistical softwares, but I like to kind of play with both. A quick summary of what we talked about. We talked about probably the most important thing in the world, which is assumptions, particularly normality and scholasticity. And then we touched base about others, just sparsity, et cetera, et cetera. But these are the two really that you need you guys to remember. We talked about students T, ANOVA, Welch's ANOVA, Chui ANOVA, paired sample t-tests, repeated observations ANOVA and Pearson's correlation, and how to run them. So today we're going to continue our journeys through the analysis of continuous data. And in this particular case, we are going to move towards skewed data. And we will see in what context particularly. And we're going to run some examples with Genovi. So, Spearman. Spearman was, well, obviously, as you can guess, a gifted statistician, but he was also a very well-known psychologist. And the vast majority of his fame comes from his theory on general intelligence, published back in 1904. This kind of laid the base for what is the modern interpretation of intelligence in humans, and has then sort of laid the ground to a massive amount of work that has been done in cognitive psychology following this publication. He worked at UCL, and as you recall, also, Carl Pearson worked at UCL. The two had a fairly troubled relationship across time. When Charles Spearman came on to UCL, Carl Pearson was already a very well-established academic. He had already done loads of research for about 6-7 years into his senior career. It was pretty much academically impeachable, as described in a number of papers out there. So we'll start looking very quickly at the work of Carl Pearson again, and then we'll look at why Spearman managed to upset him. So we talked last time about the concept of correlation. So basically, the measure of statistical relationship between two variables. And we talked about how this can be mathematically measured by dividing the covariance of the two variables for the product of their standard deviations. That's all well and dandy, and in all honesty, relatively unimportant, because any piece of statistical software can do that for you nowadays, as we will see later on. But it is important to remember that there are some relevant pieces of information in this slide that has to do with the way the numbers are crunched, covariance and standard deviations. So we're talking about measures of spread of data, basically, that derive fundamentally from the concept that the data is normally distributed, and that's where Karl Pearson's work really functions well. As I said, all of this works if the data is normally distributed. So what do you do if it isn't? And what if extreme values are present? Now, this is not uncommon. It is very uncommon. It is very common. And in this case, Pearson correlation becomes fairly unreliable. So basically, when you look at your data and you start, you know, glancing at some charts, you very quickly realize that instead of looking nicely, normally distributed without outliers, it actually looks like this. And this is data from my dissertation. And as you can see here, there are some very significant outliers. And when you try and run a correlation matrix between likes and, for example, citations of a paper, likes on the Twitter network, I mean, and time cited following the publication of the paper on other journals, you realize that your scatter plot just looks awkward. And that's probably because there are a lot of outlying variables, outlying numbers in there. So Spearman said, well, actually, I have an idea that might fix this problem. And he published a number of papers on it, particularly the one that you can see on top of his portrait, saying that, well, he could fix the problem that Karl Pearson couldn't fix. And obviously, Karl Pearson wasn't particularly impressed with that. And so he did publish a few papers in response to that. Allegedly, their working relationship in UCL was much more troubled than the papers would portray. But the papers themselves, you can see they're referring to each other in terms that are not exactly academically polite, I would guess. So what was the idea that Spearman had? Well, instead of using the absolute number that you've got in front of you, why don't you use a rank? What does that mean? Well, you remember a few sessions ago, we were chatting about an imaginary group of people growing marijuana plants and trying to figure out what worked and didn't work in terms of getting good results with grams. So if you imagine for a second that you've got four plants of marijuana here on the table on the left, right? You want to see if the plant height correlates with the grams that you get out of a plant. And as you can see, there are some plants that are fairly, I don't really know how tall a marijuana plant is, actually. I think it's much taller than that, but it doesn't matter. You've got some plants here that are fairly homogeneous, so 25, 23, 27 centimeters, and then a crazy tall plant. And you can see that they produce 3, 5, 4, and 6 grams each. When you have a value like this, your correlation matrix will be fairly upset by it. And if you try and plot this on a chart, you will immediately realize that this is an outlier. So instead of using the absolute value, you rank your plant height by first, second, third, and fourth. So plant number one will rank number two because it's 25 centimeters. Plant number two will rank one because it's 23 centimeters. It's the lowest value. And so on. And then you rank the grams equally. And this is what ranking means. And then you can see that rank number two corresponds to rank number one, rank number one to number three, and so on. That does have quite a significant impact in the way correlations calculation work, because it does reduce the effect of outliers. So if you look at this chart here on the left, there's obviously a bunch of points, and they seem to correlate towards a relatively well-established positive correlation. But there are also some outliers. If you run a Spearman correlation on this, you get a fairly high correlation coefficient, which is lower if you run it as a Pearson. That is to say, these outliers are affecting the correlation less if you run Spearman versus Pearson. It also seems to be more reliable in nonlinear relationships or small samples. So if you look at this relationship, it's clearly not a straight line, is it? However, Spearman correlations still suggest that there is a very, very strong correlation, while Pearson correlation is slightly lower in terms of the mathematical value. However, you can also see that if there isn't a correlation, they both pretty much perform at the same level, which is, again, a sign of Spearman's reliability has been slightly superior to Pearson in probably most environments. So it's just less sensitive to crazy values that can lie around in your data set. The interpretation of the result remains the same. So, you know, one is a pretty much perfect positive, 0.9 strong positive, 0.5 weak positive, and so on. So you interpret the result in the same way, but the result you get can be slightly different depending on how your points lay on your chart. A final point, I've explained this picture last time. Correlation and causation are not the same thing. You can look this up if you search Pastafarianism online. It has to do with a, let's call it a pretend religion, a satirical religion. And one of the things that are often talked about in relationship to this religion is the strong belief that the average temperature of our planet are going up, not because of what we are doing to the planet, but because the number of pirates have been declining. And this is clearly a joke and is meant to say that, again, correlation is not the same thing as causation, if that makes sense. Look it up, it's very funny. So let's go on with a practical example. For my dissertation, as you probably by now know by heart, because I've spoken about this many times, I collected data about papers that were advertised on Twitter by publishing journals. For the purposes of today's example, we're going to check if the likes data are correlated with citation data. In this particular piece of software, which is called Jamovi, as we said many times, you'll find correlation matrices under regression. We said we were going to look at time-sighted, and we were going to look at likes. Is that right? Yes, that's what we said we would do. So, we've got a few options here. What should I do before deciding whether I'm going to run a Pearson or a Spearman correlation? Let's see who's online. Pratik, do you want to have a go? What's the first thing I should check?
Should we check for stochasticity?
Even before that?
Normality?
Normality, absolutely. So for a normal distribution, I can use Carl Pearson work. For a non-normal distribution, I should use a Charles Spearman work. So I'll show you the results of both. As you can see, in both cases, you do get a statistically significant correlation between the two. However, Pearson's correlation coefficient is 0.339, while the Spearman's correlation coefficient is higher. And you can also get your correlation matrices here. So you can actually do your depiction, if you like, for your papers or whatever. To check which one I should have used, I should go on descriptives, and I should put their likes and time-sighted, and then I should look at some statistics, including a Sapir-Whorf test, which, as you can see, is statistically significant. As a result, this data is not normally distributed. Well, this is the result of the fact that the data is not normally distributed. If you want, you can also look at some plots, which will also show you the same. So you can see the massive amount of outliers we've got here, if that makes sense. We could do bar plots, histogram, density plots, whatever you like. It's quite versatile piece of software. Okay. Perfect. So to recap, regression, correlation matrix, put whatever you want to test there. We set that. And likes. Choose your one once you've tested for normality. And there you have it. You want to see your plot? Correlation matrix. And it can also show you the statistics on the chart if you really want to. Okay. Right. It was the end of it. So I'm going to stop sharing.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening. Until next time, keep ramming your life with our surgical podcast.